All right, let's pick up where we left off in 1 Corinthians. We left off in chapter 7. And this chapter 7 makes it abundantly clear that Paul is beginning to address a lot of different subject matters that, as a result of a letter that was written to him by the Corinthians. They ask him a number of questions in regards to marriage and divorce and certain moral behaviors. They asked him things about gifts, speaking in tongues, and so on and so forth. Well, this chapter 7, he primarily deals with the moral climate in regards to husband and wife, in regards to being single. And, you know, some of the things that he addresses here I think are really applicable to today. And I think that he sets forth, I think, you know, some guidelines that are just ironclad. I mean, unfortunately, we're living in a day and age where a lot of what Paul has to say, and what he has to say, obviously, is from the inspiration of God's Spirit, is pretty much discarded. But nevertheless, I think it really is applicable to every day and age. Anyway, beginning with that verse 1 in chapter 7, it says, "Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, but because of immoralities, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband fulfill his duty to the wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does, and likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement, for a time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together, at least Satan tempt you because of your lack of self-control." Now, before we go any further, let's just back up. And apparently one of the questions that was put to Paul, asked Paul, is, well, is it okay to touch a woman? In other words, is it okay to have sexual contact in marriage? Now, that might seem like a kind of absurd question, but keep in mind now, when Paul started that church in Corinth, it was really a hotbed of idolatry and immorality and ungodliness and so on and so forth. And now what's happening is that people were coming to the Lord, and they were coming to the Lord in all different circumstances and situations. For example, a wife might come to the Lord, be saved, but now she's got a pagan husband. Or vice versa, a husband may come to the Lord, be saved, now he's got a pagan wife. And one of the questions were being asked, well, if you're in a marriage situation, I mean, is it okay to have sexual relations with an unbeliever in that context? These are the kind of questions that were being posed to Paul. And so this is where he's coming from when he begins to address their questions. And he says in that verse 2, "But because of immoralities, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband." What he was referring to here is, okay, because immorality at Paul's time, I think, was pretty much like it is in our time. I mean, it was rampant. I think that it was fornication, adultery, homosexuality, and so on and so forth was the order of the day. And the Christian found himself in this moral climate, and he really wanted to know, okay, what would God's perfect will be done? So Paul is just basically saying, okay, because of this intense pressure, moral pressure, to go against God's will, it's much better if you do have a sanctioned sexual outlet. That's basically what he's saying in the monogamous marriage situation. He says in verse 3, he says, "Let the husband fulfill his duty to the wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement." Now, what he says here, to me, is a mouthful, especially when I look at some of the things that have been taught by various denominations in various churches throughout the ages, and even by governments, not just by religious denominations or, you know, sects or even cults, but the government steps in too. And the government will define things as being, let's say, sodomy in a marriage context, like, for example, oral sex. It's on the books in some states, and it's still on the books as being sodomy or being against the law and things like this. Well, if you read this, it's very, very clear what it's saying. In verse 4, "The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does." He's saying here, in essence, that in a marriage contract, a marriage relationship, the husband and the wife are the final authority. not the Pope, not the church, not the government, not any organization, no one has the authority to dictate to a married couple what is acceptable and what is unacceptable in fulfilling each other's sexual needs or desires or wants. That's pretty plain. I mean, in Christ, we do have a liberty, we do have a freedom. But we got to understand something, too, that in Ephesians, I think it's Ephesians 5, we are to submit ourselves to one another, you know, out of love for Christ. So it's a situation where I don't think that either husband or wife can be demanding. But it's one thing, it's a situation where the husband and wife need to have a mutual respect for one another and a mutual desire to fulfill the other partner's needs, whatever is important to them. And that's basically what he's saying. But I think the really important thing that he's saying here is the husband and wife are the final authority. Anyway, in verse 5, it says, "Stop depriving one another except by agreement for a time that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together, lest Satan tempt you because of your lack of self-control." When it says stop depriving one another, well, I guess this has been going on from day one. When there's a conflict in a marriage, very often pride sets in, and then neither one of them want to give in or meet the other person's needs. And if we kind of keep something in mind here, that the marriage is instituted by God, and it's a reflection of Christ and His church. It's a reflection of God the Father in the Old Testament and His wife Israel in the Old Testament. And it's a mystery. Paul refers to it as a mystery, but I think what it's pointing to is the fact that, hey, this is such an intimate relationship that it's something that you really need to give of yourself totally and completely in ministering to the other person's needs. And unfortunately, the needs aren't the same. Remember, we had that book called His Needs, Her Needs by Harold Willard. And, it's the needs very often can be conflicting, it because basically he says something to the effect, I don't remember all of them off the top of my head, but for a man, his five basic marital needs is sexual fulfillment, an attractive spouse, admiration, and domestic support. And I forget what the other one was. And for a woman, what's the other one?
They like to have a companion.
Oh, yeah, recreational companionship. Yeah, you're right. Thanks, because I couldn't remember that one. And then the woman's basically is affection.
Support, yeah. Open checkbook.
Yeah, right, yeah. Financial support and conversation. And, of course, the emotional support, but he phrases it a different way, and also domestic support, something along those lines. Anyway, I didn't want to get off on that tangent. I'm just simply saying that the needs aren't parallel. They are really, I don't want to say that they're opposites, but they're just not the same. And so it can be a formula for, let's say, strife or stress or whatever. But Paul is stressing the importance of submitting yourself to each other and trying to meet each other's needs and quit depriving each other of their needs. And he also says that in regards to the sexual bond, he says that if you're going to discontinue your sexual relationship, you only do it with mutual consent for a short period of time of prayer and fasting. He says, and then come back together because the devil can tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I mean, it happens all the time when, women start denying their husbands, then it's very easy for them to go out and find somebody who's willing to fulfill their needs, and vice versa. If a wife's not having her needs met, then, she's starting to look for needs to be met somewhere else. And, the devil's always there to say, hey, the grass is always greener on the other side. But the problem is, it's just as hard or harder to mow once you get over there. So in verse 6, it says, "But this I say by way of concession and not command. Yet I wish that all men were even as I myself am. However, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. But I say to the unmarried and to the widows that it is good for them to remain even as I. But if they do not have self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn." So basically he's saying here that by concession, in other words, this isn't a direct command from the Lord, but it's his advice, is that he wishes that people were single as he is, because his single state enables him, obviously, to accomplish a great deal more for the Lord and have more of a focus on the Lord's work. But he's saying to the single person or to the widow person, hey, if you want to get married, that's fine. My advice to you is, hey, remain single if you can. But if you can't, don't worry about it. You know, go ahead and get married. And he says, and if you have no self-control, it's much better to marry than to burn. There's been a lot of speculation as to what does that mean, to burn in hell, or does that mean to burn with lust? Well, I think that you can apply it both ways. I don't think it's necessarily just one interpretation there, but, you know, it has been interpreted both ways. Anyway, in verse 9, he says, but if they do not have self-control, let them marry, for it is better for them to marry than to burn. In verse 10, but to the married I give instructions, not I, but the Lord, that the wife should not leave her husband. But if she does leave, let her remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband, that the husband should not send his wife away. Now, he said this is from the Lord, and of course, you go back to the book of Matthew, when Jesus was talking about marriage, he was basically saying that a person who divorces his wife, marries another, commits adultery. So, I think there's some pretty ironclad safeguards that God has set up to make it very difficult to leave your husband and wife without incurring guilt before God. Now, Jesus did say, except for immorality, meaning except for unfaithfulness or adultery or these type of things. But Paul does make another exception further down. But, of course, there are other exceptions, too. I mean, where there are spousal abuse and things like this, I don't even want to get into that, because I think it's a situation where if it's in the church, if you go to your pastor and the church absolves your marriage, I mean, Christ did say about the church, he says, hey, whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, whatever you loosed on earth shall be loosed in heaven. So it's a situation where God has set up some pretty straight guidelines, but also I think God is not inflexible in terms of some mitigating circumstances. So I don't even want to get into that, because that's not what he's really talking about here. But he's just saying that, hey, man, don't leave. And if you leave, you're not free to marry again, because you're still bound to this person. In verse 12, he says, but to the rest I say, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, let him not send her away. And a woman who has an unbelieving husband and he consents to live with her, let her not send her husband away. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified through her believing husband. For otherwise your children are unclean, but now they are holy. Yet if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. The brother or the sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. Now, what he says here, I think it's been a little difficult to be really accurate as far as what he's exactly saying as far as his definition here. But I think if you break it down, take it in light of all other scripture, what he's saying is this. If you have a situation where you've got two pagans that are married together, and then the husband becomes a believer and the wife doesn't, Paul's saying, hey, stay together. Stay together, basically for the sake of the children. But also, because if you stay together, you may end up influencing your spouse and leading them to salvation. But what he's saying here is that even if you have a situation where one person becomes a Christian, the other person remains a pagan, and you have children, he said the children are sanctified through the believing parent. Now, he also said that the unbelieving spouse is sanctified. Now, that doesn't mean the unbelieving spouse is saved, because further on, he talks about, you know, the possibility of him getting saved or her getting saved through the influence of the saved spouse. But what he's talking about here is, remember, there's a bond in marriage where the two become one flesh, the two become one. Well, when one becomes a believer, in God's eyes, it's as though the parents are both believers for the sake of the children. The children become sanctified. The children are now in a situation where, let's just say if the rapture were to take place, the children would go up in the rapture because of the believing parent. That's how children are sanctified before they reach the age of accountability, before they can choose and decide for themselves. I think it's very clear that if you read in the Old Testament, you read about how God destroyed the whole world with a flood, in an Noahian flood. Well, there was probably multitudes of infant children and little children and toddlers and pregnant women that got washed away in the flood along with everybody else. It wasn't that these children, let's say, were guilty before God of sin before they reached the age of accountability. It's just that they were not sanctified through a believing parent. So even though their souls were not lost, they didn't go to hell, they still suffered a judgment that came upon the world because of the sins of the parents. Now, you know, the same thing applied to Sodom and Gomorrah. I'm convinced that even though, you know, it was rampant with homosexuality, it was still a city with a multitude of children in it. But they were wiped out along with the parents because they weren't sanctified before God. Even though their souls were saved, their lives were lost because they're sinful parents. Well, here's a situation where God says if you just have one believing parent, then it's as though God looks at the family unit as having two believing parents. That's what he means by the other spouse is sanctified for the sake of the children. Doesn't mean the other spouse is saved because they're not. They're just for the sake of the children. God views it as one unit. And so therefore, the children are sanctified before God. And like I said, if he were to come back, the children of the unbelieving, of the believing parent would be translated to go up into the rapture, but the unbelieving parent would be left behind. I think that that's what he's saying here. Anyway, he says in verse 15, yet if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. The brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. Now, what he's saying here is he's given a green light for divorce in this particular situation. If you got two pagans, one of them becomes a Christian and the other one won't tolerate it, saying, hey, you cannot be a follower of Jesus Christ. I will not stand for it. Well, then Paul says, hey, under those circumstances, let the believing partner leave, or let the unbeliever leave, or whatever it is, because he says God's called us to peace. He doesn't want them to be unequally yoked in that particular situation. But keep something in mind, too. Paul said very plainly that we are not to be unequally yoked with unbelievers. So if people, and it's been done time and time again, a believer, a Christian will say, well, this person's not a believer, it's not a Christian, but I'm going to marry him anyway, and maybe I can convert him. Well, first of all, you're being totally disobedient because you're marrying an unbeliever and you're unequally yoked. And then if you find yourself in a man-made hell that you created because of your disobedience, well, it's kind of like, as far as God is concerned, well, you made your bed, lie in it. Now you can't just jump out of the marriage because you disobeyed me to begin with. So that's a totally different, you know, situation or circumstance. And in verse 16 says, for how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? Only as the Lord has assigned to each one has God called each in this manner. Let him walk, and this I direct to all the churches. So that's what he's saying here, is that even though the unbelieving parent is sanctified, they're not saved. Because he's saying here, how do you know that you won't save them through your influence? In verse 18 he says, was any man called already circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised. Has anyone been called uncircumcised? Let him not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing and uncircumcision is nothing. But what matters is the keeping of the commandments of God, that each man remain in the condition in which he was called. Were you called while a slave? Do not worry about it. But if you are able also to become free, rather do that. For he who was called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freedman. Likewise, he who was called while free is Christ's slave. You were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men. Brethren, let each man remain with God in that condition in which he was called. So now he's dealing with another situation. I'm sure they asked him one of the questions in their letter was, what happens when I become a Christian and I'm a slave? I mean, do I leave my master, or am I compelled to still be under this servitude? Or, you know, what's God's view on these matters? So Paul is basically saying this. If you were a Jew and you were circumcised on the eighth day and then you become a Christian, hey, don't feel like now you got to somehow give up that circumcision, or vice versa. If you were saved while you were uncircumcised, don't feel like now you got to run on and be circumcised. Whatever state God has saved you in, remain in that state, because that's not the issue. And I can apply this also to, let's say, denominations. I mean, if you're a particular Christian denomination, As long as they're mainline where they have the essentials, I don't think it's necessary for people to feel like, well, I got to leave this church, go somewhere else because I was saved through the influence of somebody else. I always go by the, you know, just the rule of thumb, hey, bloom where you're planted. You know, if you happen to be belong to a Lutheran denomination, and then but you weren't saved, and then you got saved, I don't feel like there's a need for you to all of a sudden, you know, become an Episcopalian. That's not what matters. What matters is, hey, is to follow Christ, to obey Him. That's what He's talking about. Obey God's commandments. Don't feel like you've got to change your circumstances.
It could be God's will for someone to move to a different church.
Oh, it definitely could. Matter of fact, it does. It happens all the time. You know, I'm not saying that you shouldn't do it. As a matter of fact, there are times when I definitely encourage people to do it. It all depends upon the situation. It's just that Paul doesn't want people to split hairs and sling hash over things that aren't really, they don't really matter. He's basically saying this, wherever situation you are called in, remain in that situation unless, of course, the Lord is leading you out of it or if there's a good reason to leave it. You know, he does say if a person is a slave, remain in that state, but if he can be free, hey, by all means, be free. But then he also says, hey, the person who's a slave is free in Christ, and the person who is free when they came to Christ, they're a slave to Christ. So, I mean, we're all one in one. And Paul makes it abundantly clear, too, that there aren't those distinctions as far as God's concerned. He doesn't see those distinctions. And Paul says that in Christ there's neither male nor female, there's neither slave nor free, there's neither Jew nor Gentile. I mean, it doesn't matter. God doesn't see these as distinctions because we're all one in Him. Anyway, he says in verse 23, you were bought with a price, but do not become slaves of men. You know, I think that says a lot. It's you bought with a price. You know, you belong to Christ. Don't become slaves to the do's and don'ts, the man-made commandments and the traditions of men or whatever it is. You're set free with Christ and grow in the love and the knowledge and the fear of Him. Verse 24 says, brethren, let each man remain with God in that condition in which he was called. Verse 25, now concerning virgins, I have no command of the Lord, but I give you an opinion as one who, by the mercy of the Lord, is trustworthy. I think, then, that this is good in view of the present distress, that it is good for a man to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be released. Are you released from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you should remarry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin should marry, she has not sinned. Yet such will have trouble in this life, and I am trying to spare you. But this I say, brethren, the time has been shortened, so that from now on, both those who have wives should be as though they had none. Those who weep as though they did not weep, and those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice, and those who buy as though they did not possess, and those who use the world as though they did not make full use of it. For the form of this world is passing away. But I want you to be free from concern. One who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world and how he may please his wife. And his interests are divided. And the woman who is unmarried and the virgin is concerned about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and in spirit. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world and how she may please her husband. Now, he's just dealing with, whether a person's a virgin, whether if it's okay if they marry, especially like, for example, back in those days, well, a lot of times if a man had a virgin daughter, would it be okay for him to give her away in marriage? Well, Paul says that's perfectly fine. It's perfectly legit. You can go ahead and do that. But he basically says, are you released from a wife? You know, don't seek one. If you're married, don't seek a divorce or don't seek to be released. He's saying, live for the Lord in the circumstance, the situation in which you were saved, in which He found you. But he goes on to say something I think that to me is very, very practical in his advice. He says, if you're married, live as though you're not married. Now, what does he mean by that? Look at some of the other things he said. Verse 29, but from this I say, brethren, the time has been shortened, so that from now on, both those who have wives should be as though they had none. Now, that doesn't mean you run around and carousing from bar to bar and bed to bed. That's not what he's saying. He says, verse 30, and those who weep as though they did not weep. Now, remember, Gospels tell us that Jesus wept. He wept at Lazarus' funeral. But he's saying this, those who weep, weep as though they did not weep. And he says, those who rejoice, as though they did not rejoice. You know, we are to rejoice in the Lord always, but he's basically saying to all of us, he's saying, the time is short. Regardless of what happens in your life, if you're married, you live as though you're not married. In other words, you don't make your spouse the beginning and end all of your life. If you lose your spouse, the Lord takes them, they die, or even if they leave, how many people have committed suicide, or how many people have become so overwhelmed with depression that they can't function? How long, I know people have just lost their way because they've lost a spouse, or they've lost a good friend, they've lost a relative, they lost a child. God understands that it's perfectly human to feel the loss and to feel the pain and to feel the grief. But we got to understand something, that that's not the end of everything. That if your spouse dies or your child dies, don't go blowing your brains out, because then that shows that they were your God. We got to remember that regardless of what happens in our life, that God is in control and he is the one that we need to put our total faith and trust in. And everything's going to be changing for the good or bad. That's why I wear a t-shirt sometimes that says, "Are you having a nice day? You know, you'll get over it." That's what it says. I mean, I work at all times and say, how you doing? And then they'll say, "Oh, I'm doing really, really great." Well, you know, I'll say stuff like, "Well, you'll get over it." Well, it's true. I mean, I may be saying it in a joking way, but regardless of what your situation is or circumstances, you'll get over it, because everything is just temporary and life, the time is short. And that's what Paul's saying. And he says, those who weep as though they didn't weep. Well, the Bible says, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Well, you know, if you weep, that's perfectly legitimate. But weep as though you didn't weep. In other words, understand that this is just temporary too. This is going to pass. That there is eternity. There is a heaven and hell and a judgment and so on and so forth. This is just temporary. That's the way he wants us to view life and all that it concerns. He says, if we reuse the world, use the world in such a way that we don't possess it. In other words, God has blessed us with this house. But I always look at this house as just a loan. You know, this is just a loan. If it burns down tomorrow, sure, I'll be grieved. I'll probably weep about it, you know. But I realize, hey, this is not the beginning and end all to everything. This is just temporary. Everything is temporary, including myself, as far as this world is concerned. So that's the way he wants us to look at this life. He wants us to look at it through this spectacles of death, through the spectacles of eternity, through the spectacles that, hey, everything is here today and it's gone tomorrow. So don't make it your God. That's basically what he's saying. And then he basically says, hey, listen, if you're single, you have much more opportunity to serve the Lord. If you're married, it's inevitable that your attention that is going to be divided. So he's just basically giving the counsel that, hey, it's better if you're single, because your focus can be more on the Lord and the things of the Lord. I know when I first became a Christian, I taught, I was single, and I taught the Bible study for several years, and then I was debating about getting married, and reading this passage, I mean, I brought it to the Lord and just said, look, it's inevitable. My attention is going to be divided. It's just inevitable. And especially if you have children and so on and so forth. But I did, you know, earnestly pray that the Lord would give me the good grace, and it would help me to where I can minimize that division as much as possible. That even though I was going to get married, and even though I know I had God's blessing and he was guiding me and directing me to, that I still wanted to give him as much as I possibly could, even though I knew that I couldn't give him as much as I did when I was single. It was that simple. So anyway, picking up where we left off, We'll pick up in that verse 35. It says, "And this I say for your own benefit, not to put restraints upon you, but to promote what is seemly and to secure undistracted devotion to the Lord. But if any man thinks that he is acting unbecomingly towards his virgin daughter, if she should be a full age, and if it must be so, let him do what he wishes. He does not sin, let her marry." So he's basically talking to fathers in regarding to the daughters, even though he says, hey, it's better if you're single because you can devote more of your time, money, and energy and effort to serving the Lord. By saying, hey, if you want to give your daughter away in marriage, it's perfectly fine to do that. In verse 37, he says, "But he who stands firm in his heart, being under no constraint, but has authority over his own will, and has decided this in his own heart, to keep his own virgin daughter, he will do well. So then, both he who gives his own virgin daughter in marriage does well, and he who does not give her in marriage will do better. A wife is bound as long as her husband lives, but if her husband is dead, she is free to marry to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. But in my opinion, she is happier if she remains as she is, and I think that I also have the Spirit of God." And, you know, concluding this, he's basically saying, too, that if a woman or a man, if he's widowed, they have a freedom to marry, but only on one condition, that they marry a Christian. Because if they marry a non-believer, then they are being disobedient. It's going to lead to a world of problems. But he's basically saying, too, that if you've been released, if you're widowed, in his opinion, you'd be much better off just remaining single. But he also said in Timothy that if you're young, he says if a woman was widowed while she's fairly young, he encouraged her to marry. So it's not that he's being contradictory here. He's just setting down, I think, some basic guidelines in terms of what would be most fulfilling in a person's life. And all he's doing is answering questions that were, you know, put to him in a letter that the Corinthians had written to him. And, I think it's been a real tremendous blessing to Christians all throughout the ages that they had written this letter to Paul and asking him all of these questions, because he addresses things that I think that have been very important to Christians in every day and age and virtually every culture, because it answers a tremendous amount of questions that otherwise would remain unanswered as far as biblical guidance is concerned. Anybody have anyone to add or share?
It says up here, verse 37, about the, assume the father decides not to give his virgin daughter in marriage out of his own free will. It sounds like he's making the decision for his daughter.
Well, okay, put it this way. Marriage. You know, you've got to put this in the custom at the time. Okay. In that particular time, it was the father who basically made the decision when it came to his daughter, whether she could marry or not marry. Of course, in our custom, in our day and age, I mean, we don't have that.
It would go real well, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, we don't have that. So, but, you know, because our customs are different. But I think in the context of it's the day and age that he's talking about. The father was the one who gave away his daughter. And if he decided to do it, that's fine. If he decided not to do it, then that's fine. I mean, it was more the custom that he was dealing with at that time. It may seem strange for us.
The custom came from asking permission in this
right.
day and age.
Right.
They go as a courtesy
right. yeah.
to
but,
the father.
Right. But that's going out the window pretty much too, I think. Yeah. Yeah, I guess it does. You know. Did I ever ask your dad?
No.
Oh, maybe we can get an annulment.
Go ahead.
Too late now. Go ahead.
Don't get your
okay. okay.
Leave a credit card.
Yeah, see? Anybody have anyone to add or share?